Good morning, Paul. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
Good. Thanks for chatting to us this
morning.
Sure. Now, it does bring up a few questions, doesn't it? Whether or not it's a worthwhile endeavour, you know, risking people's lives to go in there, and it probably costs a lot of money as well to go and rescue people in Iraq.
Yes, I think that I guess the way to look at it is the following. Citizens of democratic governments have an implicit contract with their governments. They behave and pay taxes, and the government provides them with security at home and abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And that security comes in the form of travel advisories, protection. Let's say if you get in trouble in some country, the embassy will look after you or try to render assistance and the like. But when you have a group like this who goes against very specific warnings not to go into a war zone because the governments in question cannot provide assurances of security in the event that they get in trouble. In fact, the governments are very specific that they're on their own if they go there. Then these groups implicitly will break that implicit contract.
And in particular, we're looking at the Christian peacemaker team. I guess
right.
They're answering to a higher power?
They may perceive themselves as such. But what I found interesting about this case, and mind you, I see no wrong in people violating government edicts because of principles. You know, in this case, you know, people who are very peace-oriented and want to do good, I don't see that. That's an individual choice, and good on them for doing it. However, when you go into a war zone, you better have a backup plan in case your first plan doesn't work.
Mm.
And in this case, they did not. What I found astounding was that spokespeople for the CPT, the Christian Peacemaker Teams, said that they had no one on the ground who could help them contact the kidnappers. In fact, these gentlemen spoke little or no Arabic, went into a neighborhood that they were completely unfamiliar with, and got themselves in a lot of hot water, and had absolutely no backup plan, so they had to turn to the very same governments that had warned, the Canadian government in particular, that had warned them specifically against undertaking that mission.
So it sounds like a bit of naivety. I mean, had they not done operations like this before?
Well, they had done them in Palestine. I mean, the Christian Peacemakers are a laudable organization because they've gone to, for example, Colombia, where there's a civil war. They've been heavily involved in Palestine, opposing the Israeli occupation, so they have a very good history of trying to get in the middle. But Iraq is a whole different kettle of fish. In Iraq, what you have is two overlap conflicts. You have a war of resistance against a foreign occupation, and you have sectarian strife between Shia and Sunni Muslims overlapping on each other. And the last thing that Iraqis want right now are more foreigners in the mix. In fact, the recipe to stability in Iraq is based on subtracting the number of foreigners involved rather than adding foreigners to the mix. And in Iraq right now, their kidnapping for ransom schemes are a growth industry. 10 to 20 Iraqis a day are being kidnapped for prices ranging from $500 to $10,000.
Mm.
So these guys land in the middle of all of that. I sort of think that maybe it wasn't naivete, but it was ignorance and recklessness on their part to jump into those particular waters, again, without a backup plan. I mean, these guys didn't even have disaster insurance. I mean, the costs of this affair are not going to be borne by the Christian peacemakers, their volunteers, and their supporters. They didn't go out, for example, and immediately start trying to raise funds to pay the ransom demands. And so I think if you didn't even insure yourself against the possibility of disaster in the form of a kidnapping, perhaps you really shouldn't have gone.
So you've gone in there and you've been captured, you're hostage, so you turn around to the same government to advise you not to go in there. The government would be in their right mind to say, well, you're on your own, really.
They would be, but that's the interesting conundrum of democratic governments, particularly governments such as the Canada's or New Zealand that are very responsive to their people. Even in the face of such reckless acts, good democratic governments will try to help people out when they get themselves in these sort of dire straits.
Mm.
But I like to draw the parallel with people who do very risky things at home, and let's say go into a avalanche zone against all the warnings of the experts, or get themselves in trouble in a river and require being hauled out by Coast Guard and boats and whatnot. in New Zealand and in Canada, among other places, oftentimes those people are charged with the costs of their rescue.
Right.
And I see no reason why this principle cannot be applied to people who go abroad against travel advisories, against the directed advice of their governments, and get themselves in trouble in war zones. Mm. And mind you, this principle that you will have to pay the cost for your rescue if you do so doesn't just apply to peacemakers. It applies to would-be mercenaries, thrill seekers, nutters, I mean anyone who would be attracted to a violent situation abroad.
Who pays for this? Because it's quite complicated, isn't it? Because, say, a country like New Zealand, who has an interest in Hamid Sudan because he's a New Zealand citizen, do we pay America to go in there, or this crack force of American and British and Australian SAS troops? Or, you know, does money exchange hands at all?
Not really, but let's clarify something. Mr. Sudan is much like me. He's a permanent resident of New Zealand, but he's not a citizen. And that's important because it's the taxpayers of the countries involved that pay the freight for their rescue. In this case, it was Canadian. It was Canadian tax dollars that paid for this. And what they do is there's an exchange relationship. The rescue operation was led by Canadian and UK SAS, and there's some rumors of New Zealand SAS involvement that haven't been confirmed. They were supported by Iraqi and American special forces, okay? The Americans played a very secondary role once the intelligence on the site where these guys were being held was obtained. But it was the SAS from the two countries that had the most vested interest who went in and got these guys. And we have to remember that the costs of the military operation were actually the small part of this affair. A ransom was undoubtedly paid, and then you have all the diplomatic endeavors and activities that went on during the 4 months these guys were in captivity, in locating the kidnappers, talking to them, negotiating the deal. That cost time, effort, and undoubtedly a lot of money changed hands to facilitate the transaction.
Right.
That was all paid out of the wallets of mostly Canadian taxpayers. I don't think that the New Zealand taxpayer paid for Mr. Sudan's rescue this time around. But again, the principle is such that perhaps down the road, where New Zealanders are more involved and Canadians are the minority of a hostage situation, then the New Zealand government will in fact be the lead agency in trying to rescue them,
so
at which point we'll pay.
Surely no insurance company would cover this if you were required to pay for this yourself.
Well, believe it or not, there are many, many insurance schemes for exactly this purpose. These private security contractors, people who do humanitarian assistance under UN aegis, for example, all have to pay admittedly high premiums, but they buy exactly that. It's called security insurance or disaster insurance.
Right.
And that's, again, the Christian peacekeepers apparently believe, I guess, that they are inviolate, and they didn't take out any insurance. Not at all. I mean, that's not part of their charter, and I think that gets a little rich. It's stretching credulity to think that somehow, because of your spiritual nature and whatnot, you're bulletproof.
Mm.
And in this case, certainly in the case of the American hostage, Mr. Fox, it was proven that he wasn't. And I will point out, there is something good to be said about negotiating with kidnappers. You know, you hear the old phrase, and the Americans definitely use it, which is, we will not negotiate, we will not pay ransoms. Mr. Fox became expendable as a result of that policy. The interesting thing about engaging in negotiations is the longer you draw it out, the more you give your security, more time you give your security forces to get the intelligence that allows them to locate the hostages and effect a military rescue. So I would say, just from a pragmatic standpoint, regardless of the public posturing, negotiate rather than flat refuse not to, because your hostages are dead men as soon as you refuse.
Do you suggest passing some kind of legislation in New Zealand to cover this sort of situation?
Well, it depends on the New Zealand electorate, but I certainly think it would be worthy of debate. I think that governments can sue to recover the costs of these sort of operations. But that's the less likely instance of them trying to recover damages via civil lawsuit. But I do think that the possibility of very, very specific legislation saying that if you go into a war zone against the specific direction and travel advisories and whatnot, and you get yourself in trouble, you will be responsible for the costs of your rescue or release. Now, this allows democratic governments to go in and rescue people. It doesn't prevent them in any way, shape, or form from not affecting the duties that they feel obliged to carry out. Mm. But what it does is it shifts responsibility for paying for such things to the reckless individuals who get themselves in trouble against the advice of the government.
Well, Paul Buchanan, thanks so much for joining us on the show this morning.
It's my pleasure.
Paul Buchanan is the director of the Working Group on Alternative Security Perspectives at the University of Auckland.